You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. People with student loans had to start paying them back again in October after the end of payment moratoriums started during the pandemic and after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled President Biden's loan forgiveness plan unconstitutional. The Biden administration has a new plan to help people pay off their federal student loans. The new plan is less expansive than the initial plan and would only help people in certain categories, not across the board. This new plan is also likely to be challenged in the courts, and even if everything goes smoothly, it would still be probably at least a year until it could be implemented. So what should borrowers do in the meantime? We're talking about the return of student loan payments and the possibility of some forgiveness on the horizon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did student loan payment moratoriums affect you? Did they change your financial situation over the last few years? How's the resumption of payments affecting you? What are your thoughts on different kinds of student loan forgiveness? The options on the table? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy Mayotte is the president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Betsy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we get to this new Biden administration proposal, can you talk about the reinstatement of student loan payments and how that's been going nationwide so far?
Oh, boy. So this is a sort of an historical event in the world of student loans. We've never had a pause, never mind a 3.5-year pause. And then consequently, we've never had 40 million borrowers all reentering repayment at exactly the same time. Obviously, because of that high and sudden volume, people are experiencing some bumps in the road, such as very long call hold times sometimes, and some delays in processing, perhaps if they applied for a lower payment option. But I think the vast majority of borrowers have been able to ease back into repayment fairly pain-free.
A bit of advice here. If someone is hitting these repayments and realizing this is more than they can realistically fit into their current budget, are there options out there for them?
Yes. So thankfully with federal student loans, there are quite a few different options. Excuse me.
Such as
lower payment options. There's multiples of those, as well as deferments and forbearances that will outright stop the payments. The Department of Education's website, which is studentaid.gov, is the best place to go to start researching what those different options are.
Now let's turn to the Biden administration's new plan. We saw, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court nixed a previous version. This one seems more narrowly targeted. Can you talk about the scope, first of all, of what we're seeing from the White House?
Yeah, so I was pleased to see that President Biden is attempting to take a second bite at that sort of broad forgiveness apple. He's going about it in a very different way because of the results from the Supreme Court. And because we're still sort of in the beginning of this process, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like yet. But it appears, as you mentioned, that it won't be as broad as what his initial proposal was. It looks like the direction they're going in is to identify several sort of extreme factors that borrowers might be experiencing that's causing long-term hardship as a result of their student loan and contemplating forgiving their loans if they fit several of those criteria. So for example, if someone has been paying on their loans for a significant amount of time and maybe their balance is still what they started at or even higher than what they started at, or maybe the borrower has a high balance and has been paying for quite a bit of time and they're elderly and it's clear that they're not going to be able to work or increase their income. Maybe there's someone that maybe should have qualified for an existing discharge or forgiveness program, but because of some quirk, they weren't able to obtain that. That might be something else that they're looking at. I do want to point out, though, that regardless of what happens with this particular initiative, the Biden administration has already forgiven over $1.2 billion in federal student loans for well over $1 million under some other smaller initiatives that have been taking place over the last 3 or 4 years.
What kind of situations have people been in that has gotten them at least some level of forgiveness?
For example, there is an existing discharge for people that are totally and permanently disabled, But there was a real barrier within that discharge that caused people that were initially approved to have their loans kicked back in. So the White House got rid of that particular barrier. A broader example is with the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. There was a temporary waiver in place during part of the COVID period that allowed people who maybe weren't under the right repayment plan or had been given some misinformation in the past about PSLF to get past periods to count towards that forgiveness program that normally wouldn't count. They've done some great strides with a discharge program for people that were defrauded by their schools. And that was an initiative, that was a program that the prior administration was firmly against and did everything they could to roadblock it. And so this administration has opened that discharge process back up and provided relief to quite a few borrowers that were defrauded by their schools, such as there was a big story about Corinthian colleges, for example. And then there's a current initiative that's going on right now and will continue to go on through next year to give people credit towards forgiveness based on payment plans that are related to their income.
We're talking to Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, looking at student loan debt, a new plan on offer in the early stages here from the Biden administration that would forgive a student debt in certain circumstances, and looking at the reinstatement of student loan payments after a fairly long moratorium because of the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about your student loan debt situation or your kids? Do you have thoughts? Did you get a change in your monthly payments one way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy, as we've mentioned a couple times, this new Biden plan, the early stages here, what would have to happen between now and I don't whenever for these changes to come into effect?
So the process is called negotiated rulemaking. And the first step of that process is a series of meetings with affected parties to try to come to agreement of what the new regulation should look like. We're about to have the third in the series of three meetings. From there, the Department of Education will publish draft regulations, at which point anybody can comment on those draft regulations. Every single one of your listeners, you, me, your brother, your sister, your mother, maybe not the dog, will have an opportunity to comment on those. And the Department of Education will review those comments and then issue the final version of those rules. Now, that process normally takes about a year, but it is my understanding, and I'm getting the sense, is that for this particular negotiated rulemaking, they're sort of putting it on the fast track. So while normally I wouldn't expect to see final rules before next November, I would be surprised if we didn't see them well before that, maybe as early as August or September.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hello. Great conversation. Thank you for having the guests on as well. I just got a general question. What changed over the years where the students needed forgiveness now in their student loans compared to, for instance, like in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s when I graduated and, you know, had to pay that back? Other than COVID, did COVID just stretch everything out where all of a sudden the loan payments are due quicker, or what's the circumstance?
Jim, thanks for the call. Betsy, having been a college student in the 1980s and having kids in college now, tuitions are one big difference. Can you talk about what has changed in the intervening decades?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You're right. The first thing is that the cost of higher education has gone up dramatically, well beyond the general sort of cost of living increases over the years. The other thing that's happened, and one of the reasons for this, is that since the 70s, the states have drastically de-invested in higher education. So the cost of attending your state school or your local community college is much, much higher than it was back in the 70s or even the 80s, which means that more people have to take out student loans to be able to afford their college education. The average student loan debt today at the national level is about $37,000. And even 10 years ago, it was only around $23,000 or $25,000. The other thing we're seeing is it's taking people a lot longer to repay their student loans than it used to. The most recent data, which is not recent at all, is from 2012. And at that point, it was taking the average federal loan borrower about 15 years to repay their loans. And back in the 80s, it was taking an average of, I believe, and don't quote me on this last statistic, but I'm fairly certain it was only about 5 or 6 years to pay off student loan debt.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Carla is with us now in Fox Lake, Illinois. Carla, hi.
Hi. I've been paying off my daughter's student loan debt for over 10 years, and it's down to $13,000. My daughter works in the arts, will not make more than about $23,000 a year this year. And I was told by someone from the agencies to just not pay anything. Just don't even try and process anything. I'm wondering about the wisdom of doing that.
Carla, thanks for the call. Betsy?
That's a terrible idea. You know, right now we're in what's called an on-ramp period. It's something the Department of Ed set up to understanding that the repayment restart might be bumpy and to make sure that borrowers weren't harmed by those bumps. And during the on-ramp period, failure to pay your loans is not going to result in a negative reporting to your credit report, but interest is still going to accrue and you will still be considered delinquent. A much better solution for this caller's scenario is to have her daughter apply for what's called the SAVE plan. With her daughter's income of $23,000, her payments will be zero under the SAVE plan. So, and the interest will be subsidized. So she won't be accruing interest as long as her payments are a $0 payment. And because her actual bill will be $0, she won't show delinquent. So there's all kinds of benefits to actually just getting on the SAVE plan rather than just letting it ride and letting the loan go delinquent.
Thanks for that call, Carla. Good luck to you and your daughter. Deb joins us now in Waukesha. Deb, hi.
Oh, hi. Good evening. Yes, this is my question. Okay, I am going to be 70 in January. I had been on, of course, forbearance as everyone else, and I had been on the, when I was working, because I worked until like I was 67, I was on the income-driven repayment plan. But then once I retired, and I'm working just minimally part-time, I had been dealing with Great Lakes, and they had said, well, frankly, you don't make enough, so you're going to be paying zero, I think, forever, because if I had to start paying, you know, it wouldn't look good for me as far as my long-term viability. And so I've been on zero for during the forbearance, but also because of my lack of income coming in. But nonetheless, I have that debt that is still there. You know, when you do your credit, it's like, okay, your current debt load, credit cards, which is like I pay mine every month with the student loan, you know, is big. It's a lot. So I'm wondering, in my circumstance, is there any way we could just like get the eraser and erase it all?
Interesting. Deb, thanks for sharing that. Betsy?
Eventually, but not right now. So it sounds like you're still on an income-driven repayment plan, which is exactly what I would have recommended for you in your circumstance. Another benefit to those income-driven plans is they all have a baked-in forgiveness component, where if you're on the plan for either 20 or 25 years, and whether it's 20 or 25 depends on what kind of loan you have and what plan you're on, but if you still have a balance after you've been on those plans for that period of time, they will automatically forgive it. So you just have to sort of wait it out. Make sure you recertify your income and stay on the plan annually when they request it from you. And then eventually, once you hit, sounds like you might have another either 10 or 15 years left, it will automatically be forgiven.
Deb, thanks a lot for the call. Betsy Mayotte is with us, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, talking with us about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan and the resumption of student loan payments this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know from our guest expert about paying student loans or not paying them, as the case may be? What kind of policy changes would you like to see at the federal level? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, talking about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan in the early stages, not taking effect yet, and advice for managing the resumption of student loan repayments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you dealing with loans yourself? Do you have questions about how this all works? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Betsy, let's go to the front end now. People about to go to college, maybe there right now. What would you tell them about how to handle debt in those early stages?
Oh, I love that question. So, you know, one of the things I'm seeing with people that are looking on how to pay for college now, and this is a downside, all this talk about forgiveness, is I see people making debt decisions, assuming that their loan forgiveness will be available to them down the road. And, you know, people should never borrow assuming loan forgiveness. So that's number one. Number two, when you're borrow, especially for your first year, look at how much you need to borrow for that first year, and then multiply it by five and figure out what your student loan payment would be. And is that something you're going to be able to live with? Keeping in mind that you might be making that payment for 10, maybe even 20 or 25 years. And that's going to affect other financial decisions like buying a house or maybe even getting married or having children. The third thing I want to mention is I would love to see people in school getting in the habit of paying at least some, if not all, of the interest as it accrues while they're in school, even though they're not required to. That tip can actually save you a lot of money in the long run.
Let's bring on another caller. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that have student loans that are from the 2008 crash. When I went to MATC, 40, 50, and 60-year-olds outnumbered the younger kids, because you couldn't find a job unless you had an associate's degree, and they didn't even care for what, for a $12 an hour job. So there was a whole slew of us from the milk companies, the construction companies, that are stuck with debt just because we had no choice if we wanted to live.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Betsy, do you see a lot of people concerned, probably in a couple different ways, who got hit? They happened to graduate or be in school right when the Great Recession struck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this brings up a policy point that I think even a lot of policymakers don't realize, is that student loan debt is no longer just a quote unquote young person's issue. And a lot of that has to do with what your caller described in the 2008 recession. A lot of what we call non-traditional students went back to school. So today, half of all student loan borrowers are over the age of 30, a quarter are over 45, and the fastest growing age group that has student debt and the group that struggles the most are the over 65s. And a lot of that has to do with the 2008 recession and also the fact that it's taking longer to pay those student loans off.
Thanks for the call, Tim, and good luck to you. Priya joins us now in Chicago. Priya, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
What's your situation, Priya?
So I'm in debt for almost $200K. I have been paying my student loans for maybe 6 or 7 years. I'm on the SAVE plan. I've done, you know, I think if you reduce your AGI, you can get on the SAVE plan. It's because it's income based. But I was wondering if you have any advice for me.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left, Betsy, for someone in Priya's situation, a younger in their 30s, big load of debt, already on the save plan. Any thoughts?
I would look into whether you might qualify or be able to get a job that qualifies for public service loan forgiveness. Otherwise, you know, depending on what your income is, I would stay on the save plan and just make sure that your strategy is the one that's going to cost you the least amount over time. And it sounds like you're headed in that direction already.
Priya, thanks a lot. Good luck dealing with that. Betsy, in our last few moments, again, we started with this Biden administration plan. If I'm hearing you correctly, nobody should look at that and say, oh, I would be eligible for that and base their financial future on it. Wait until it actually happens before planning around it. Do I have that about right?
I could not have said it any better.
Betsy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Betsy Mayotte, president and founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. She talked with us about the Biden administration's new student loan forgiveness plan and the resumption of student loan payments. Still time for you to share your story, your situation, your thoughts, maybe on policy changes. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, remote work led to empty offices in a lot of communities and a big hit to commercial real estate in the country. Find out why that could affect the economy for everybody. And when we have an injury or an illness, a lot of us try to get back into action right away. That's not always for the best. Find out why we should take time to heal with the author of the book, Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. Plus, we'll take a look at a new ethics guideline from the U.S. Supreme Court, issued by the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out what's in it, what kind of changes it can make, and as always, you can share your thoughts. Let us know your questions right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join those conversations coming up Monday. That's here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The internet, video games, food, sex, gambling, all of these things can be fun and make us feel good, but for some people, they also have the potential to become addictive. Behavioral addictions are not all recognized as equally legitimate, especially compared to substance use disorders. Our next guest will break down similarities and differences between behavioral addictions and substance-related addictions, and how to know if a behavior is becoming an addiction, and how to get help if you need it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced behavioral addiction? How did it or how does it affect your life? Have you sought and have you found treatment? Is this something that's been an issue in your family? Join in with your experiences or your questions on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Steinman is a clinical psychologist with a doctoral degree in clinical psychology, at UW Health and an assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW Madison. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob. I'm so glad to talk about this very important topic.
How do we define behavioral addiction in the first place?
Yeah, so this is really the difficulty. The guide that psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists use doesn't even have behavioral addictions other than gambling disorder yet included. So it's nothing that we can formally diagnose. However, there are proposed criteria being put forth that are actually very similar to what we're seeing with substance use disorders. So people having a tolerance, having to engage in more and more of the behavior in order to feel the effects, even withdrawal symptoms from things like behavioral disorders, feeling more irritated, difficulty with sleeping when you're not able to engage in those behaviors, and it just having consequences on you both personally and professionally.
What are some of the most common types of behavior that people have these, whether or not we call them addictions, these addiction-like behaviors associated with?
Yeah, so I am definitely seeing more and more video game addictions. And so parents being concerned as their teenagers, particularly when they go to college, these young adults engaging in this behavior to the expense of their studies. And then just the amount of time I think that all of us spent on the internet during COVID, starting to question how much of this is a problem and how much is that taking over my life day to day.
A lot of these are common behaviors we're talking about, right? Using the internet or playing video games, or it might be shopping or food, or the list goes on and on. How do we start to see if our regular everyday behavior is becoming something different? It's becoming a mental health concern.
Such a great question. And I think it's really looking at the impairment that that is causing. And so while a lot of us have probably stayed up later in the night that we meant to doom scrolling, when it turns into more and more of a difficult behavior that's having consequences on our daily functioning, this is when it might be a time to take a look at it. And if the person tries to set limits and is really failing at being able to do so, that might be a time to seek additional support and help around it.
Speaking of help and support, what kind of treatments are out there for people with a behavioral addiction?
Yeah, so again, with the difficulty of even getting the diagnosis, mm-hmm. like I had talked about in the beginning, it can be difficult to have a treatment provider who specializes in these things. And so oftentimes treatment has to start with taking a look at maybe anxiety or depression that's going on as well. Or there is a diagnosis called impulse control disorder that can kind of encompass some of these behaviors that are happening. And so with treatment then, that's often going to look very similar to treatment for substance use disorders. So a person who already has some specialty in addiction might be an ideal person to seek help from. And the additional plug that I am going to put out there is looking into some self-compassion groups in your area or even online. Oftentimes, the root of these addictions happening is because of shame that hasn't been addressed. And so when you feel pretty terrible about yourself, you're looking for ways to help you feel better. And when we find those, it can be really easy to get caught up in them and get distracted and not be feeling those deep-rooted feelings. And so then that addiction can form.
Now, if someone knows someone with an addiction of any kind, substance, behavior, whatever, it can be easy to look in from the outside and think, buck up, a little willpower, you can control this, whatever. It's not, as in my limited understanding, it's just not that simple, is it?
Very much so. And so, again, if you think of someone stepping in and telling you not to do something, how well that goes over. Imagine something that this person is actually getting a lot of enjoyment out of, despite the consequences. And so we're learning more and more about willpower and it just not being very applicable to a case where it has changed the wiring of a person's brain. The reward pathways are now different for this person when they're engaging in that behavior. And so it's not as simple as just say no. We learned that campaign did not work with substance use disorders. It doesn't work very well with behavioral addictions as well. And so it's really having the willingness to come to the person and have these conversations and talk with the person and try to understand where they're coming from and come with that with love and kindness.
Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us from UW Health talking about behavioral addictions, regular behaviors in some cases that get out of hand, cause negative impact in our lives, what we can do about them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have a question for a guest or maybe an experience to share. Now, Stephanie, some of these things might be easier to avoid. A gambling problem, there are ways to maybe stay away from gambling environments. That's harder these days with the internet. For something like food or shopping, right? These are things we need to do every day. Does that raise the problem when you're regularly confronted with that thing you have that behavioral addiction to?
Very much so. And so this is what my patients are often talking about. With things like alcohol and other drugs, there are some pretty clear limits that can be set with that, although I would say in Wisconsin that's a little bit harder than some other states I've lived in. And like you were saying, with food, even with the internet, of talking with people, of this is something that they're going to have to use for school or work every day. There's not going to be that abstinence-only model that you can take with the treatment. And so it's really working with them on how they can figure out their triggers and limits that they can still set around it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So when I was working on my undergrad in history and political science, I minored in psychology. And one of the questions that I had was, why hadn't something like alcoholism died out in the past? And I came across some research which said that by people being alcoholics in the past, it actually made the society at whole sometimes more ready for problems that were coming towards them, because when there was some sort of loud noise or an explosion or some sort of other event, people who had the addiction tendency would be the ones who would run towards it to find out what it was, while people who did not have that same addiction would then go back and warn the village. And so it actually provided an advanced warning, in a sense, which helped all people survive.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Interesting, Stephanie, I don't know if you want to get into the evolutionary history, I guess, behind addiction, but in the present day, is there such a thing as a more addiction-prone person?
So we do know that genetics play a role, and the research is already starting to merge about behavioral addictions as well, that there is a genetic component to it. I can't speak very much on evolutionary psychology. Research is still being done on that, but fascinating to look at. And again, really important, I think, for family members to be educated, because so many times addiction is not discussed. And then, unfortunately, it can continue because people are just not aware that they are at a much higher risk of experiencing an addictive disorder.
Marcus, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned just now behavioral addiction, something we don't necessarily talk about. I think we're just starting to get to a point where people are more willing to talk about substance abuse disorders, other mental health concerns. Are you hopeful that we're going to be more open and willing to talk about these behavioral addictions that many of us might find personally embarrassing at the very least?
Very much so, through exactly programs like this, which is why I'm so glad to be here and talking about it today. And as many problems as people might have with TikTok, I think it has been a great resource for actually reducing stigma and discrimination around mental health and addiction disorders.
Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us. We're talking about behavioral addictions, how they might be similar or different to other types of addiction, what they look like, how to get help, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen certain behavioral addictions become more prevalent or more recognized over the years? Have you seen things like video games or the internet becoming more addictive to you or someone in your family? If you are dealing with this yourself or with a family member and you're willing to share your story, we'd love to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman from UW Health, assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison, talking about behavioral addictions, what they are, how they're diagnosed and treated, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried that you or a loved one might be struggling with some kind of behavioral addiction? Is this something you've experienced in your life that you're comfortable sharing with us? We'd appreciate it if so. Do you have questions about diagnosis, treatment, what it looks like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jay joins us now in Wisconsin Rapids. Jay, hello.
Yeah, howdy.
What did you want to bring up, Jay?
Well, I was wondering, I had a question for the psychologist. People who are engaging in addictive behaviors and these patterns of behavior, has the research found that they're doing this because they need further pleasure through the behavior, or are they using these addictive behaviors to run away from and mask painful realities within their life? It's running towards or running away from, I guess, is the basis of the question.
Interesting question, Jay. Stephanie, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. And it's actually most likely a combination is what we're seeing. And so in the beginning, that oftentimes something has happened. If trauma is a part of it, they're definitely at higher risk for developing an addiction. And then what happens once they start to engage in that behavior over and over, it actually changes their reward pleasure. And so needing to get that hit more and more often in order to feel good. So we have this combination of first running away and then really running toward.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. What does it take for someone to recognize that they have a behavioral addiction? I'm imagining for many people it might develop very slowly, maybe so slowly that they don't notice that they've gotten there.
Yeah, and so this is where the friends and the family members are often the first ones to speak up to them, even before the person themselves is recognizing the impact that it's having on others around them, which again is why I think it's so important as friends and family members to know this is definitely something to talk about. It's just in a way to come at it with compassion for the person, so that then the person feels more comfortable of starting to address the problem within themselves.
I've had a lot of conversations with experts on various elements of mental health who talk about the value of peer support. And you touched on this earlier, talking about, you know, reaching out if you can't find treatment, there might be peer support. Can you talk more about what kind of things might work? What kind of communities are out there that you see as at least potentially helpful?
Yeah. And so, again, because this isn't even fully recognized yet, there's definitely more limited peer support for the behavioral addictions than the substance addictions. Although Sex Addicts Anonymous is available for people. And then NAMI is a fantastic organization. I'm actually on the board of directors for it. But for people with mental health issues themselves, but also for friends and family members, that those support groups are available. And then, like I said earlier, I really want to emphasize looking for some kind of self-compassion group. Being able to develop that for the self and others can be really life-changing for people.
I want to talk more about that concept of self-compassion, because as I understand it, there can be kind of a shame cycle. Oh, I know I have a problem with fill in the blank there. I feel bad that I have this problem, but the thing that I'd reach for to deal with that shame is more of that problem. Is that a self-perpetuating cycle?
Very much so. And so this is where we really need to figure out how to interrupt it in a different way than our brain is kind of naturally attuned to, which is to come in with that judgment of, oh, this is bad or wrong, I shouldn't be doing that. And trying to use that as a motivator, unfortunately, just leads us back to the behavior that we're trying to stop in the beginning. And instead, if we can come in with kindness, understanding, and recognition of the common humanity that this is how it feels when a person is suffering, it really interrupts that shame cycle. And then they have a whole new pathway that they can open up within their brains in order to make some different choices.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Maciej is with us in Mount Pleasant. Maciej, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you guys today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Well, like I was telling you, the person that I spoke to before, I came from Poland when I was 10, 11 years old with my mom and my sister. When I came here initially, obviously it was a financial situation where we struggled. And I can remember being in middle school, a young girl said to me, "Those are the three shirts that you're wearing all the time. Why don't you have any more clothes?" So see, that sort of stuck with me. And now I have shirts. My big thing is shirts. I have one closet full of shirts. I have another closet full of shirts. I've got a pole that I put down in the basement where I hang shirts up on. I go, you know, I'm in Target or Kohl's and I see something on the clearance rack for $2 and I just can't help but buy the shirt. I know, you know, I can wear a different shirt every day for a year and I wouldn't wear the same shirt twice.
Have you sought help? It sounds like you recognize this as not an ideal situation. Have you looked for ways to break that understandable shirt habit?
Oh, I have. And, you know, I've broken it for like periods of 2 months or so. Then, also, you know, when the seasons change, I walk into the store and the stuff that's seasonal suddenly is on that clearance rack. And it's like, you know, it's like a fish to a worm. I'm attracted to it in the worst way. Next thing you know what, I'm walking out with 8-9 shirts, you know, which I, believe me, I really don't need. You know, and it's less than $20. How can I not buy them? 9 shirts for less than $20 with tax.
Maciej, thanks for the call. Good luck with dealing with it. Now, of course, Stephanie, I won't ask you to diagnose, treat a caller over the phone. But starting points, if a client comes to you and has a comparable problem, what kind of things do you start talking about?
Yeah, Maciej, I mean, I just want to thank you so much for being vulnerable. So that's actually the first piece that I talk about, is we have to name it to tame it. And so you're doing a great job of being able to see the recognition, and you're really highlighting exactly what Rob and I have been talking about, is you recognize where that shame developed of that girl making that comment in elementary school. And so now what we have to do instead is start to feel it, to heal it. And so be able to go back to that kind of little kid within you and offer love and support in that moment, because he just wasn't understood, that there wasn't very much money in the family. And again, trying to fill a hole with the shirts, it's never going to work, just like with any other behavioral disorder. We have to actually get to the root of the problem.
Maciej, thanks again for that call. Clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman is with us from UW Health and UW Madison, looking at behavioral addictions. Something else that Maciej said that struck me, Stephanie, is, you know, he's kicked it for a couple months at a time, a month here and there. Maybe this, for any kind of addiction, as I understand it, is fairly common. People might break it for a while or a year and bounce back. Challenging the idea that was a failure as opposed to a first step, maybe. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, so I run a group for kids, and they taught me FAIL stands for first attempt in learning. And so can we all start to reframe what FAIL means, and that we can keep learning from ourselves again and again. And it's actually so great for our brains to be able to recognize when there has been a lapse or a relapse and what we need to do different next time. And so getting away from this kind of black and white thinking of either I'm doing it right or wrong, of I'm being a human and I get to be here and keep trying over and over. What a fantastic thing to do for our brains to keep learning.
I wanted to ask, we've been mostly focusing on grownups here. How about that that parent or other caregiver who has a child or maybe a teen, and they think they see some emerging behavioral addiction type behaviors? What do you say to them? How can that parent help out?
Yeah, and so the great thing about parents is you have more of that executive functioning and can step in and see these things a little bit earlier. And so ways that you can set boundaries. Of recognizing you get to have control over the Wi-Fi password and when that gets turned on and off, and be able to set those limits in place that the kid just isn't able to do yet for themselves, and that you can also hopefully then get them into treatment sooner rather than later, because you have more of that responsibility over their day-to-day, and to make sure that they're getting to school and getting the good sleep that they need.
In just our last half a minute or so, are you hopeful that the psychiatric and psychological professions will take behavioral addictions more seriously in the near future?
Very much so. And there is already hope in the latest DSM. Internet video game addiction is being put under there for consideration, which means they're doing a lot more research on it. They just want to make sure that they're getting the criteria correct and that we'll be able to have most effective treatment in place once that does get moved into the DSM.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. I really enjoyed this conversation.
That's clinical psychologist Stephanie Steinman with UW Health, assistant professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW Madison. We talked to her today about behavioral addictions, how to know if a behavior is becoming an addiction, and how to get help if you need it. If you want to know more about substance and mental health treatment programs in your area, you can call the free and confidential national helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-4357. You can also visit findtreatment.gov. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.